Attention. This podcast audio was recovered from a redacted time and location. It contains disturbing banter between a woman and her bestie about found footage movies and is the last known evidence of their existence. This pair haven't been seen or heard from since. So welcome to the show, everybody. It's your favorite time, ding dong darkness time. And I'm Allison Dixon here with my best good pal, Chris from 80s High. And if there's anything our nearly 30 years of friendship has affirmed, it's that we share a mutual love of some pretty twisted stuff. And one of those things, which is going to be the subject of today's show, is horror movies, but not just any horror movies. We're talking about one specific subgenre today, found footage.
Oh, I thought this was about found feet. Like just, you know, people out in the woods and they just find a, I can get you a toe, dude. You know, like.
I was going to say, no, isn't that Quentin Tarantino movies?
Those are basically,
all,
yes.
All found foot movies.
Also, kudos to you. You got through that intro in one take. Amazing. Because you swore you were going to screw it up.
I did practice a couple times before, but
that's great. And I'm so jazzed to be here to talk about our found footage philia. So
yes, not
wait.
I am very excited. I'm a huge fan of this style of storytelling. I think it's because the barrier of entry for me is so low. So if I'm watching archived footage or reading purported diary entries or letters, I feel like I'm looking at stuff I'm not supposed to. So it just like amps up that whole voyeurism thing, which I shamelessly admit is one of my great weaknesses. If it makes me feel voyeuristic in any way, I'm just glued to it. And it doesn't matter if it's manufactured. So psychologically, if it looks forbidden, I'm in some way invested in it. So what about you? Like, what is your draw, man? What brings you here? What makes you love the found footage?
I think it's some of that same stuff. Like a lot of the movie making artifice is gone, right? Like we are put into the perspective of our protagonists and we're stuck there with them and we only see what they see. And so much like, you know, your eyes and your body, you can only take in so much information at once. You're kind of stuck there too. You don't get to zoom out. You don't get to see more of what's going on around. If they don't turn to the left, we don't know what's to the left. There's certainly a voyeuristic aspect, as you mentioned, but I think also there's a claustrophobic kind of personal aspect to it as well. So few movies can actually plop you into that character's POV. And some of these movies keep you there. Others, you know, kind of play around with it. You know, we'll get multiple perspectives or we can talk about some of the different variants that stray from that. But at its core, that's where you're stuck. And as a device, horror is probably one of the best genres through which to experience it. Others can do it very successfully, of course. But, you know, like I'm sure there's a found footage comedy. I don't know, but it could be a rom-com found footage. But I think what's fun about it is horror plays on a lot of those same aspects. So it's got a just a real built-in appeal, I think.
You're absolutely right. I actually had that written in my notes about how this device and horror just go together hand in hand, mostly because I do think that the limited point of view lends itself to added anxiety and dread. So the less you see, the scarier it is. It follows the whole Jaws rule, as we've talked about a few times on this show. But I love this too, because the existence of this storytelling device well predates cinema. The use of epistolary, as it's known, goes back many centuries and refers to the use of diary entries, letters, and other correspondence and news articles to tell a story. So I did some research on this and I wanted to see how far back this went, because many modern day or sort of well-known examples of this would be Call of Cthulhu, or really a lot of work by H.P. Lovecraft, Dracula, Frankenstein, again, all horror related. Stephen King has used it quite a bit in a lot of his short stories and novellas. But some of the earliest examples of epistolary started as basically compilations of letters that were like put together that people could read as a narrative. And this goes back to the 1400s and continues up through the 1600s. There's so many different examples of this, but then there was one, it was said the first work to fully utilize the potential of an epistolary story was called Love Letters Between a Nobleman and His Sister, which already sounds quite scandalous.
Excuse me, what?
Also a horror story, I would assume, just given the title.
I mean, olden times, inbreeding, you know, keeping royalty in the family, who knows?
I've talked about that on this show before.
You sure have.
And this work was published anonymously in three volumes. So 1684, 1685, and 1687. So they had to wait 2 years for that final entry. It's almost like being a Sopranos fan.
It's just, I mean, but it's better than being a George R. R. Martin fan, that's for sure.
It's been attributed to a person named Alfred Benn through its authorship and remains disputed to this day. And it shows the genre's results of changing perspectives. This is all from a Wikipedia article that I'm reading from, by the way. It says individual points were presented by the individual characters and the central voice of the author and the moral evaluation disappeared, at least in the first volume. Further volumes introduced a narrator. The author furthermore explored a realm of intrigue within complex scenarios, such as letters that fall into the wrong hands, faked letters, or letters withheld by protagonists. So this person was getting pretty clever with it. And as we'll find when we're discussing found footage movies later on, that there are so many different ways you can disseminate information to the viewer. And so this person already had this in mind when they were writing this weird incest book, which is just, you know,
what look at you being inventive back in the 1600s.
I know, how dare you, right? I thought you were all just dying of the plague, but apparently you were coming up with a whole new subgenre of story. But yeah, it's really interesting too, because, you know, we think of what is the origin of the found footage movie, and you know, we're going to talk about that in good detail. Chris dug up some really great info, and I watched a video on this too earlier, because I saw this movie without knowing any of that. But I'll get to that in a second. Yeah. So,
wow. All right.
So a lot of people think that Cannibal Holocaust from 1980 was the first found footage horror movie, but in fact, Orson Welles, he of Citizen Kane and the mind and voice behind War of the Worlds, did write and direct what is technically known as the first found footage film, called The Other Side of the Wind, in the early 1970s, but it was not released until 2018. But it does not surprise me at all that somebody like Orson Welles would have come up with a found footage film concept, given what the War of the Worlds really did. I mean, it was very meta. It really did make people believe they were in a story that was happening around them at the time.
Yeah. People running from their homes, terrified. Like, he was the OG in terms of, I mean, we'll talk about Blair Witch, but I feel like, you know, of a broadcast that people thought was real at the time. And then you get to a found footage movie that people thought was real at the time.
Yeah.
And so in some ways you can only do that once.
Exactly. I have not seen The Other Side of the Wind, given that it was released only relatively recently. I'm very curious to go and check that out.
Yeah.
But the one that is considered the OG and really should be, regardless of what Orson Welles was doing in the 70s, is Cannibal Holocaust, a film from Italy that was released in 1980.
So you saw this movie,
yeah,
not knowing you were seeing a found footage movie. I got to hear this story. We all need to hear this story.
No, when? This was probably about 10 or 15, maybe even longer ago. I think it was actually, I was living out in Washington and I was at a friend who lived in Seattle, and he just, you know, popped it on. He had it online. It was like some probably pirated it or something. I'm not naming names here. And we watched it, but I didn't know the story behind the movie, which is really crazy.
It's crazy.
So Chris, why don't you take the lead on that one?
Yeah. So like how the movie even came to be, are we going all the way back?
Well, we could do that, but I mean, we could also just talk about the stuff that made it infamous. We could set it up. So the found footage was presented as this, you know, camera crew that went into, what was it? A rainforest of some
Amazon
rainforest. And they encountered like a tribe there and, you know, shit went wrong and their footage was found. These film canisters were found and recovered. There's some narrative surrounding it. There's a whole third person narrative device that surrounds that footage, right? Because the people that found it, they wanted to turn it into a documentary. And there were problems with that. The guy that was like playing that person that was making it was like, I don't think we should do this, because he's watching the raw footage that is recovered. And it's really disturbing. And this movie is quite disturbing.
Yes.
All on its own. And that's why it sticks in the brain so well. And again, why it didn't surprise me that it came from Italy, because they just make really disturbing horror movies in Italy. So, but I had no idea the infamy that surrounded the making of this. I just took it on face value of just watching a horror movie, but right. It was a horror in real life in many ways.
Yeah, the director really tormented a lot of the cast, and there were a lot of arguments on set. He was really forcing people to do things they did not want to do around nudity. There are some sexual violence scenes that are going on, and it was just, by all accounts, very rough for the cast. And on top of that, they all, when they signed on to do this movie, had to sign a contract that they would disappear from society for a year.
This is insane, by the way.
I mean, my goodness, what a clause in a contract.
Say if you were on the OJ jury, or you're like sequestered, you know, and you're
And let's put a pin in it. We all just went through a pandemic and people are like, you know, I got through it. You ain't got no Netflix, folks. You ain't got no Spotify.
No DoorDash.
No DoorDash, no podcast. You are in like 1980.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not leaving.
You don't have any of this stuff.
It was like both a stroke of brilliance and the seal of fate, a stroke of death in a lot of ways for what happened to this director.
So a lot of torment and just kind of problems making the movie. And then when it comes out, I think within a week, it's pulled from theaters. Is
10 days.
Right? 10 days. It's pulled from theaters. And he's arrested on obscenity. The director, it's Ruggero Deodato. Mm-hmm. And he's arrested by the authorities on obscenity, which there's something to that particular charge. I can't remember what obscenity does entail. It's basically, it's kind of like, I don't want to say bad taste. Like, you know, I think it's because of the simulated, you know, forced sexual scenes and things of right. that nature. Well, in the process of that, he is also charged with murder for several of the cast members because they think this is real. Again, at this point, it's so convincing. It's thought to be real. And then on top of that, there are charges of animal cruelty, because unfortunately this is real. Several different kinds of animals are killed on screen.
Yeah.
Which also tormented a lot of the cast members. Like, that was also very heart-wrenching for a lot of them. I think rightfully so. So you just have all of this craziness. And so the contract he had his cast sign to disappear from society ultimately kind of was against him, because he needed those people to verify they weren't dead. So in order to clear his name, he had to let that cat out of the bag, I think, within a month of the 1 year contract.
Yeah. His whole goal was verisimilitude, right? He wanted something that looked real. I mean, and he pulled that off. He got these people to sign this contract and go away for a year. They actually killed the animals. And the one detail that really got me was there was apparently a monkey. They beheaded a monkey, but they didn't get the first take right. So they had to behead two monkeys. And then they were like, well, all the animals we killed, because there was a boa constrictor and there were a few other, like some kind of raccoon or whatever. And they were like, oh, well, the tribe that we were working with, when we were making the film, they just ate all the animals that we killed. So it was okay. You know, they just ate them. So that's how they reasoned it. But there right. was definite animal cruelty. And in fact, it's that one detail that makes this movie very divisive for horror fans, because while they want to maybe recognize that this is an astounding achievement in filmmaking, what went into making it was kind of, it makes people feel very uncomfortable. And if I had known that they were really killing those animals, I probably wouldn't have agreed to watch it, because I don't want to watch things actually die if I can avoid it. So keeping it within that framework of fiction is, you know, what most of these other movies aim to do. But Cannibal Holocaust, definitely, they took that leap. They took that, and it was a very successful movie. I think they said in Japan, it was second only behind E.T. in the money that it made. And it was pretty successful in Italy. And here in the US, it was actually banned once all this came out.
It is banned in several countries. I think some may still have it banned. I think a lot of them have since obviously lifted that, but I think some countries it's still banned.
Yeah, it is.
Including the US. I mean, here it's not anymore.
No, they lifted that ban in 1985, I believe. So this is definitely a movie that we say, sure, go watch, but with caveats, because if you have extreme problems with animal violence or watching any kind of sexual violence on screen, you know, that's just a warning, a content warning of sorts.
And oddly, I don't think there's much cannibalism in it. Like for what the whole premise of the movie and what you would expect, I think there's only like a scene that was described. I have not seen this movie. I will say, as much as I love the genre, for a lot of reasons, this one does not appeal to me.
Yeah.
And which is kind of unfortunate, because I would love to see what I would say is the first entry.
Right.
You know, even if Wells did do that movie, if you don't release it until later, like it doesn't really count. Like you can write it, but
right.
You know, in terms of an entry into the genre, subgenre, it's got to be out.
Agreed.
You know, it's like, I wrote the best book. Well, if no one's read the darn thing, we don't know about it. Like, who freaking cares? So yeah, but I think by all accounts, this is like the first to actually come out.
And, you know, we're going to go down a list of movies that we both really love, or movies that we watched to get sort of into the spirit of this episode. There are so many of these found footage movies, and it really had its heyday the most, I would say, between 1999, if we talk about Blair Witch Project, and then going through the 2010s. I would say that in that span of like 10 or 15 years, I had a lot of found footage movies. And a lot of the ones that I have watched or liked are probably around the 2012, 2011, 2013 kind of a span. Mm. But I have watched several more since then. But I would say the genre is pretty stable overall. People are trying to find new and different ways to do different things with it. So for instance, this is why I'll bring this one up first, because it is the newest entry, I would say, in the genre, is the film Deadstream. It just came out a few days ago, like within the last week, and it's a Shudder original. And it's very much brought into the modern day because it's told from the point of view of a disgraced YouTuber who's trying to get his clout back because he said something that he shouldn't have said. And in midstream, he kind of pulled like a PewDiePie where he kept using racist terminology or something. So he was quote unquote canceled. He decides that in order to get his reputation and his sponsors back, he's going to live stream from inside a well-known haunted house. Mm. And he locks himself in it. He has a live stream going at the time. You can see the chat running. And then he plants cameras all over this house and things unfold from there. And it's really neat in how it brings in that element of the live stream and the chat. Anybody right. who's ever been on Twitch or a YouTube stream, you know what that looks like, scrolling up the side, and you can kind of see what happens there and the interactions that happen between the audience and the person on screen. And the movie is definitely on the sillier side. I would say, you know, it has some good jump scares. I love the setup. I love the framework of the live stream element, but I didn't find it particularly scary. It was just more like entertaining. And I would say too, and I'll go, I have a list that I'll get in when we get all done talking about our movies, about sort of like the laws of good found footage.
Do we want to start with that?
That's actually a good idea.
I think it'd be great to just like start with all of that before we get into it, because I feel like that could really help with some of our discussions of these, particularly when they fall flat. Agreed. Or run afoul.
That's such a good point. Let's do that first. I love that idea.
Can we talk about just like what the genre entails typically?
Yes. So the whole hallmark of a found footage movie is that somebody took, you know, footage with a camera. It could be a phone camera, handheld camera, professional video, whatever, of a horrifying event. And then this footage is later recovered in some way by some entity. And we are getting to peer at sort of what is believed to be the last moments of this group of characters that went through this thing. Did you have something else you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, just that there's, you know, different cinematic techniques that are utilized. You know, we've talked about the first person perspective. Some of these are presented as documentaries.
Yes, yes.
And so they really have that style that I think if you've seen a doc, you're pretty familiar with that. They might employ news footage or surveillance footage. Some of them will have interviews with experts or law enforcement who are investigating friends and family of the missing or whatever. And so there's a lot of these kind of common elements that you might see. And obviously, you know, they really go for a naturalistic look in the sense of you have shaky cam.
Yes.
Sure, we'll end up talking about that. And, you know, often the characters are the ones who are utilizing the camera. They're the ones who are, you know, holding the camera. They've got a GoPro attached to their head. They've got their phone, whatever the case might be, right?
It's funny how you put that because the first law of found footage movies, and by the way, I watched this really great video on YouTube by the user or the channel Rotted Reviews. They do a lot of horror type reviews. So he came up with this list. I'm not using the whole thing because I felt some of the stuff was a little nitpicky or ran into the other things. And I added a little bit, but this was a good foundation. So the first one being that the camera is a character because it provides a level of dimension that isn't in typical movies. So we're in the shoes of the character. We're not outside a fourth wall. We are really in it. And so in order for it to really work, the camera has to be the character. It has to be accounted for in every single thing that happens. And you cannot just bring in another camera without explaining how it got there. You can't just cut from a shot without explaining why it would be there. And there are some movies that unfortunately break this law a bit. Yeah. And I'll get to that in a few. But anything that sort of breaks the immersion is breaking the law of a found footage film. And the way that that immersion is really created is by the use of the cameras.
That's a great point. And I think what's also interesting too is the camera is a separate character because we see movies where the camera gets separated from its person, right?
Yes.
Or it changes hands. So it's not synonymous. It is a vehicle for us to look at the movie, but we've all seen those shots where the camera falls and then we see what's happening in the distance or whatever. So I like that distinction very much.
Yeah. And another one is they say a good found footage movie should have, though, despite all of this, when you mentioned the GoPros on the heads, he actually brought that up in this video, but he said these movies, the best ones, should still have a director of photography because it's not just about strapping that GoPro to your head. You need to really still understand framing, lighting, ISO, all these things that cinematic people get to a certain extent. And so if it works and still doesn't look like it's planned out, like it still looks very spontaneous, there's still been a good bit of planning that went into that to make it look that way. And so I always come back to one that I consider a pinnacle of this genre, which is Hell House LLC, because I do feel like they did such a good job with this. The movie is really well filmed. It's really well staged, but it still feels very organic.
Great point.
And it's like anything else. When somebody says, oh, that was such an easy read, that was such a breezy movie, well, it's just, there's so much work that goes into that. And a lot of people try to cheap out and say, oh, I can make a film found footage movie for super cheap by just doing this, this, and this, like whatever, but not necessarily. So sure. Another one, and this is interesting too, is the use of music, because there are some found footage movies that have sometimes had music kind of creep in that wasn't organically in the scene. Again, it's all about the immersion factor, right? So
right.
Death Stream was actually really interesting because the streamer, he brought along a tape deck. And so he was like playing mood music, like as right. He was doing his thing. And there are some other people that have introduced music in an organic way that it's like, it's just there because it's playing in the background. But
right.
If you're having this really tense moment and there happens to be music that you associate with a normal movie, it should really be there organically. And some have broken that rule.
Yeah, like you get the violins or something that or something like that. Like you there needs to be a reason for it. And yeah, I think that would definitely. Is there a movie that violates that
I
he noted?
can't, he didn't note it offhand, and I'm trying to think. I might have encountered one without noticing, because cinematic music is one of those things that's so automatic
That is true.
that if you hear it, you might not automatically think, oh. But a movie that did a really good job of this that I just watched again today was Grave Encounters. And there was a moment early on in the movie where they're in an abandoned mental hospital, locked in as this ghost hunting crew.
Oh, it's so good.
And it's really good.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to call out to this ghost or entity or whatever, and like tap on something. Well, the spirit or whatever pushes over like a hospital gurney, and the wheels are spinning on it, but you don't know what that is. You just hear like this sort of spinning sound as they're running toward it. And I'm like, is this music? What the hell? And then they get in the room, and it's just these spinning wheels
Oh,
on the gurney.
interesting.
And so it
I
served as
forgot
both
that
like
part.
a score and a sound effect at the same time. So it was really well done. So the next law is to vary the different types of fear. So a lot of found footage movies rely on jump scares. And I would say that is probably like the thing about this genre is it's a great opportunity to get jump scares. And I love a jump scare. Honestly, that I know they can be overdone, but I'll just say I'm a very high-strung individual. So
As I can attest to,
yeah, and
and I
so
terrified
jumps,
the crap out of you that one
and
time.
I'm still never forgiving you for that.
Rightfully so.
I am prone to them, and because I do tend to like fall into the rhythm of a particular moment, and anything that like comes from the outside, my husband, even whenever I'm typing on the computer, like working on a book or anything that I'm like really into, he has to be very careful about how he approaches me, because I usually have headphones on. And so he's learned ways to like get my
Yeah.
attention without scaring me. So the jump scare is definitely a big thing, but the best of the found footage movies will definitely find ways to build that terror and that dread and that suspense. And all those things play a role. But honestly, that's true of any horror film. I
True.
think The Conjuring is one that I think over relies on the jump scare, even though they do a pretty good job of building dread in some ways. And that's not found footage, my apologies, but it starts to feel like a cheap trick if it's overused. So you got to be very careful.
Yeah, that's definitely one you want to be super conservative about your use of it. If obviously it shouldn't be your main deployment of fear. I kind of feel like you get one, like in a lot of movies, you get one good one. And if there's more than that, it does tend to feel a little bit like manipulative. And the unfortunate thing is then that takes you out of the movie.
Yes.
I think you can get one really good one. And if it's done well, it kind of breaks the tension and it lulls you into a false sense of security. And a
Yes.
good movie maker will then find a way to capitalize on that, where, okay, we released a little bit of tension. Now we got them where we want them.
Exactly. And I think that's really it right there, because you can do big reveals and terrifying reveals without the jump scare. Everybody knows the jump scare, different from so many other types of horror moments. And another one that, and I really like this, and then this is one that I kind of want to get into a little bit, and this and the next one, information dissemination. So found footage movies can do a lot of things that regular movies can't, and how they provide information to the audience. And so in found footage, as you mentioned earlier, Chris, normally you are seeing what the character sees. You're sort of locked in that POV, but those moments, like you said, when the camera's dropped, or say somebody's taking a selfie or doing something else with the camera, and there's something going on in the background that they can't see. In Hell House LLC, they have cameras all over the place, and we see some things that are moving in those cameras that they don't know about. And it automatically shifts that focus to, suspense and terror, because when you know something that the main character doesn't know, it amps that suspense level in a really big way. And the found footage movies that manage to do this in a very clever way, I think, stand out. So I mentioned Hell House, but, and I know, I don't think you sound like a big fan of this one, but Lake Mungo did this also pretty well.
I wouldn't say it did it well, it did it.
I really like that movie. I know we'll discuss that one a little bit. But yeah, so anything that can really kind of keep you immersed, but at the same time, give you that little bit of extra knowledge is just adds that extra layer.
Yeah.
And then Chain of Custody. This is the final one, and it's the big one. It's that when you're watching found footage, it's assumed, of course, that someone found it. But what happened between it being found and us watching it? So documentary style ones that we're going to talk a good bit about do a great job of this, because they build the whole element of like, we already found this and we're utilizing this footage to tell you this story. So you eliminate a lot of possible plot holes that way by building a framework around it, but some of them don't always provide that information. And there's one I'll talk about in a minute that I feel like broke this chain of custody. And as an adjacent to this, why is the camera there in the first place?
Yep.
So in the best movies, it doesn't always hold up. Why someone is always recording something during this time of like intense terror and trauma? Why are you still holding a camera? Put the fucking camera down. And oftentimes that's made a source of tension among the characters. Grave Encounters did this a good bit.
Right.
Blair Witch, big one.
Yep.
For that. Paranormal Activity, so many others. They always have to address, why do we still have the cameras rolling even at the height of this? So I think though that the movies that take the faux documentary approach, I think handle this the best. Those are the main laws that were laid down. I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that, but that's that.
No, I think that's good. I think I've got a few other things. I would love to talk about hallmarks or tropes of the subgenre, but I don't know if we can maybe table that for a little bit, or if you want to talk about it now.
Let's do it. We're already on it, man. Let's do it.
To your point, like there has to be a reason for the camera to be there. And so often we do, like a hallmark is you get a description of why it's there, what they're doing, you know, they're trying to make sure that the audience knows, why is somebody recording? To your point, why are we recording all the time? Why are we recording seemingly pointless conversations or side chat that don't seem to be a part of the main business of whatever they're trying to do, make a documentary, whatever. And so it's a hallmark. And like you said, some pull it off very well and others kind of stretch that a little bit and you sort of have to suspend disbelief in some ways. I feel like a lot of these movies have one person that takes things too far.
Yes.
What are you doing? Why, you know, it's the whole argument of like, you just keep trying to make a movie. What's your motivation now? You know,
exactly.
We're lost and you're trying to fucking make a movie. You know, it's that kind of a thing. There always has to be that one person that's like, usually like the director or the leader, the person who's out there. So like in Blair Witch, it's Heather. And then Willow Creek, it's the guy who wants to find Bigfoot. It's the husband. And so it always feels like you have that one person that does that.
Oh, and Paranormal Activity. It was like the boyfriend was coming off as a total psychopath and she's like suffering.
Yes.
And going through some stuff. And it's like, bro.
And that's the thing. It's usually the person goes too far in the face of other people being traumatized. You're absolutely right. But there's like something about them that compels them to keep doing this. That happens a lot. Almost all of these at some point, shut off the camera, shut it off.
Well, they're like even throwing it away. Or grabbing it. And then it's like, and then, okay, you're back.
And then always it's okay, it's off. And then they just set it down low and then you still get the scene. Like that happens in so many of these movies. Okay, I turned it off, but they really didn't. A lot of these have that slow build of tension. They're typically a very slow burn. And for people who love this genre, that's what they love about it. For people who want the scares and they want to see the things or whatever, they're often very put off by these movies because it's like nothing happened for an hour.
Wasn't there one that you were talking about? I can't remember if it was you or somebody else and I talking about like one that just gets right off the bat with it.
Maybe we'll come up with it. It's not sounding immediately familiar, but I mean, that would certainly be a new take and defy a viewer's expectations who are, you know, familiar with it. And that would be kind of fun. I think a lot of them do rely primarily on psychological terror. As you said, there's a lot of tools in the arsenal, but I feel like it's not so much the gore factor. It's not seeing a bunch because a lot of these movies, you don't see a whole lot.
No.
A lot of it's left to your imagination. And so it really kind of builds on psychological terror. And the other one I thought was fun is, you know, a lot of them do kind of front load with a mythology or storytelling.
Yes.
Because they're investigating an urban legend, a spooky place. And so, you know, Blair Witch, good example. By the time you get to the woods, you're front loaded with a bunch of terror. You've been to the grave site. You've heard the local stories. You've heard the urban legends. and now you're there. So you've got so much going into this walk in the woods, so to speak, this, you know, this trek in there. And yeah. a lot of these movies do that so well. So those are a few things that I kind of thought were like hallmarks, sometimes tropes of the subgenre.
And you're right about that slow burn. I think in everything that I've watched over the last couple days did some form of that, where you really are establishing this. And I think also they really want to do that to make it so that you get somewhat attached to these personalities that are in the film, because empathy, I think, is such a main driver of this genre. If people who love this genre, I think, tend to be on the more empathetic side. And so they find it easier to slip into other people's heads a little bit.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah.
Because I fully agree. But why does it feel like every movie has to have at least one person that you freaking hate?
That is such a good question. I think it is almost like it puts a brake on it, right? Because I feel like if you loved everyone the same in a horror movie, then you probably would come away way more traumatized. I think there has to be someone in there that you want to see eat it, because it's just another way to break the tension in some ways. It's like, all right, if this guy dies, it'll be fine, but they better, you know, the final girl better still be the final girl. You know what I mean? But you're absolutely right. There's always a very unlikable personality in a horror movie. In Grave Encounters, oh my God, he was one of the other camera guys. I mean, he was just like disruptively annoying. Yeah. And I'm like, the personalities in that movie, to me, were just the weakest part of it. I think almost every character in it was super annoying.
Yes. I think that is one where that was strained. I don't want to talk too much about these movies because I know we're going to talk about them, but I feel like often if it's a couple, it's the husband almost always.
Oh yeah.
Like I said, in Blair Witch, it's Heather, but I just think it's interesting. I mean, you know me, I might be on a psychopath scale somewhere, but for me, like, I always want it scarier.
Yeah.
Like your freaking terrifying book, I was like, I kind of wanted it to be crazier. And other people were like, I couldn't sleep for a week, or you traumatized me. And I'm just like, you got to push farther. Like, I'm crazy. So for these movies, like I, especially at this point, like you said, there's so many, they've been around for decades at this point. Yeah. Like, I want to love all the characters. Like I'm tired of the one jerk guy Bridge. Like, can you kill this dude already? Cause no one's going to give a fuck when he's gone. Like, I hate this guy.
I think that needs to happen across the entire horror genre.
I mean, absolutely. Yeah, this is not found footage only. Yeah. This is freaking all horror.
Because you're so right. I think it probably is like the mainstay of the entire genre. It is in nearly every horror movie that I can think of, even the ones that I absolutely love. There is always that one character that you want to go. And it's like, oh, is this how we like vary our characters? Like, there's always that annoying friend or whatever, but no, that's not the case.
Yeah. And it's to a different extent. Like, some of them aren't super annoying. Like on rewatch, Heather is pretty obnoxious on Blair Witch.
Yeah.
Which I didn't notice, I think, when I watched it initially. Like, it wasn't as obvious to me, but and sometimes they're not just like, they're either aggressive or they're not listening or they're rude to other people or an egomaniac. Like, it can manifest in different ways, but I'm like, I kind of want a movie where that doesn't happen.
Who's the creep and the sex pest? You know, there's always that too. There's always a creeper. There's always like a same guy. Fucking
creepers too. Like, no, you're
even
right.
In, like Hell House, which we love. There is the one, but you know, they kind of even turn that trope on its head a little bit where you kind of end up feeling bad for him like halfway through it. It's like, all right, you were a creep, but holy fucking shit.
Yeah. Like I don't know. It's interesting. I would love to see a movie where you like everybody, and would it be effective or not? Maybe it's not effective. Maybe there's something that, you know, filmmakers get that I'm not getting.
Because I don't even know. Maybe The Descent, I would say those characters are all pretty like equally
that's
likeable.
That's true, but they had to manufacture.
Again,
I don't want to talk too much about The Descent because we'll descend into that story way too far. But they had to manufacture a character conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt it was very manufactured. I would have loved that movie without that backstory. And maybe there's an example that as we're talking about these, we'll be like, well, wait a minute, there was no one really kind of obnoxious in that one, or.
Yeah, honestly, if any of you could think of a horror movie where you absolutely love all the characters and don't want even one of them to die, please let us know, because right now I'm drawing a blank and it is definitely a thing in horror and only horror. Because if you think of other genres, I don't think that any other genre, action, romance, comedy, whatever. Yeah, there's always like the goofball friend, but somehow that goofball is like way more obnoxious in a horror movie than he is in a comedy movie.
Well, I mean, do we start talking about like the explosive breakout Blair Witch? Because it's really for most people where it all began. Sure, Cannibal Holocaust came first.
Yeah.
But if we talk about what popularized and what really blew up the subgenre, I think it's no doubt there's Blair Witch. But there is another movie that comes out a year before Blair Witch.
Yes, and I want you to talk about that one because I did not know about this one.
I didn't either until doing this. So, I mean, widely regarded, again, what came first, blah, blah, blah. There could be academic debate about it, but I think it's fairly, for something to be commercially successful, Blair Witch Project, I think is it. Like that's the first one, 1999. Well, there's a movie that comes out a year before it, 1998, called The Last Broadcast. And a very similar premise. You have a group of people. Now they do like a cable access paranormal kind of call-in talk show sort of thing. You can imagine what that looks like. And that's exactly how it's presented. And the idea is this group gets a recommendation through this mysterious means. I think it's IRL. Or, I'm sorry, IRC. IRL is in
IRC,
real life.
yeah. Yeah, it happened IRL.
IRC is not IRL, but anyway, so IRC, like they get this thing, like you should go to the Pine Barrens to investigate the Jersey Devil, which is a very well-known urban legend in that area. And so this group, their show's not super successful. So the whole idea is they set off to investigate, and the two co-hosts are joined by this guy who's a purported psychic who's going to take them to the location and going to lead them to where they can find the Jersey Devil or whatever. And so it's presented as a mockumentary, a documentary, piecing all of this stuff together. There's a narrator, he's talking through it. There's interviews, there's intersperses of like footage from the show, there's commentary, all that kind of stuff. And then ultimately it kind of leads to the end, and I won't spoil it or anything. And there's a lot of conception that Blair Witch kind of took from Last Broadcast. But the thing is, it's hard to know what comes first. Blair Witch had been sort of conceived of since 1993.
Right.
So they had been talking about that. Was it 6 years prior to it actually coming out? And Last Broadcast came out in 1998. So while they share similarities, and you could easily think like, wow, they came out around the same time. Was it like Armageddon came out within a week or a month of?
What was the one with Morgan Freeman as president? Yeah, that was Deep
That
Impact.
was Deep
Sorry.
Impact.
Okay, yeah. But you're right. All these apocalyptic disaster movies of the mid-90s.
Right. And it's like, I don't actually know the backstory of it, but my initial guess is like it was just happenstance. They both came out because how long it takes to develop a movie, it's not like, oh, they're starting this movie, we should start one too. You need a script. There's so much that goes into it. Like the idea that one of them like picked up on it and started making their own movie, it's kind of silly. But anyway, so this movie did technically come out before, but arguably not anywhere near as commercially successful as Blair Witch Project because of the viral marketing. I mean, what that's what it really comes down to. Brilliant, brilliant marketing that really set Blair Witch apart from Last Broadcast. So I watched it. It was like free on YouTube.
Was it the worst 90 minutes I ever had? But
I'll say this, if they both went out commercially, I think Blair Witch stands the test of time. I don't think Last Broadcast does. There's a lot narratively that Blair Witch Project does that you don't get in this other movie. And so even if they both came out kind of like at the same time and were equally as publicized, I think Blair Witch is the superior film in pretty much every way possible.
yeah, and that's the thing too. Blair Witch happened at really that sort of just, putting ourselves in this time frame. Chris and I were teenagers when this movie came out, and My first time on the internet technically was 1997 in the high school library. And then I graduated from high school and my parents got me a computer for my graduation present. And then we got America Online. So it was around late 97 that I was a regular internet user. And right. So when Blair Witch came out, we'd been on the internet for about a year and a half. And, you know, we're kind of getting the idea of how it worked, you know, being able to go to like websites and look at stuff. And I remember, though, there was a mock, it was a, what we now know as a mockumentary, but at the time, this was on Discovery Channel. Okay, it was, I think it was called Sticks and Stones, I think it was called.
Well, I'm a little confused about this because there was another one that was on Sci-Fi Channel.
Might have been Sci-Fi.
Curse of the Blair Witch.
I remember.
But there is a Sticks and Stones one too, so it's a little confusing, but... Is that how we first learned about it? Do you remember?
That's how I learned about it because my mom saw it first. And she
and then I think you guys told me because I remember being at your house and you guys were telling me this story and like chills. Because again, we thought it was real. These kids went out there, disappeared. There's, oh my gosh.
And they were like, they found this footage. They found the tapes and like this, you know, house or uncovered and all this stuff. And I'm just like, oh my God.
Like they talked to the professor that Heather had come to with a thesis. And, you know, like it was so well done.
And I've compared notes with people. So I talked to Brett from the prosecutors about this same thing. He was like, he went to the theater. I think we had slightly different experiences, but I know he did and I did went to the theater to watch this thing before we knew what was really up. Because here's the thing about the dissemination of information. If you're living in a world where there's no social media, then you're really at the whims of whenever you happen to be online to catch something or talk to somebody about something or, you know, whatever. So you could see a headline and not hear anything else for a while, days or weeks even, if you're not paying attention. So, you know, I watch this documentary, I go about my life, I have two jobs, I'm going to college, I'm, you know, my life is insane. So I just took it at face value. And then, oh, Blair Witch Project, it's coming out in the theaters. Oh my God, we get to watch this thing. And so show up, watch the movie. And I sat trembling in my seat for several minutes after the movie ended. I was crying, but not in like the sad way. Like I have this thing.
It's a release of tension,
yes, right? Whenever I go on like a really intense roller coaster, whenever I have any kind of really scary high tension experience, I cry. Like it isn't like sobbing, but it is my eyes are leaking tears.
Yeah, so for sure.
I'm like sitting in my seat, eyes leaking tears, and just had no idea what to do with myself after I saw this movie for the first time. I was like completely taken in by it. And then I remember going and looking at the website for the movie because they had a whole thing on the website that was just like, this is the investigation. This is the tapes. This is the pictures. This is, it was not presented as a Blair Witch movie website. It was, this is the Blair Witch Project.
Absolutely. And that was never, I mean, that had never been done before, you know, for, as movie marketing, because movies didn't have websites when they came out, before they came out. Like that just wasn't a thing back then.
Such a new thing. And all of that coming together just added, it was really seen as one of the first viral internet marketing campaigns. And it was hugely successful, probably contributed a lot, well, really contributed a lot to the success of the film. But the movie itself, well, people are very divided on this. So, because it, the movie is very bare bones. There's not a lot. I mean, these people, the actors, very not well known. The directors sent them into the woods with a very general outline, with the cameras that they were operating themselves. The actors were filming themselves.
I think two of the three had never really used equipment before, so they got like a crash course. I think Josh, guy with the beard, he was hired because he had operated a camera before. But Heather and Mike, they both had to be trained on cameras, and then the DAT, the audio for Mike.
And that's the thing too, is the audio. And I should say, like even going back to the law list, you know, they mentioned the camera is a character. So is the microphone, if we're being honest. True. I think that the sound in a found footage movie is so important. This is a genre that Unfortunately, I don't know that plays very well if you have trouble listening or, you know, can't hear if you have to rely on captions, because I think the sound mixing is a big part.
I am getting chills right now because I am thinking of the final scene of Blair Witch.
I know.
And how the sound is far away.
Yes.
Like it's away from Heather and you hear her screaming. Oh my God. Chills.
Yes. Oh, hair and like in the other part of the house. Oh my
yes.
God. Yep, same. Just had that same response.
Because you hear the audio from downstairs, but you see her going down the stairs. So it's like this disconnect. Oh,
well oh my done. God. And also like the beauty of it too is even whenever they're encountering things, and there's a moment where she goes out, they're out of the tent at night because they're hearing things, and and you hear the sound of like rocks pinging on things, yep. And things mm-hmm. like sticks being stepped on, and she's like, it's all around us. And here's the thing, even if you don't necessarily hear it that way, you're already so invested in what these people are going through that you believe her, and so you're in it, and it doesn't matter necessarily how well you hear it, you're just like taking her word for it. You're like, oh my God, is it all around us? And you're like listening for it and you're freaking out with them.
I wonder if in surround sound, it actually does sound that way.
I think I'm going to like find out after we record this. I think I'm going to go on and watch the damn thing, because I haven't seen it in a few years.
Yes.
And you know, yeah. But yeah, they were sent out with this thing and they weren't given a script. I mean, I think they knew the beats of the story that they had to follow. But another thing is that those sounds that they hear in the woods from their tent, they didn't know about any of that. The production people for the movie were the ones out there making the sounds, terrorizing them. And so all the reactions that you're seeing are genuine. Like they didn't know about that. They are freaking out. They don't know. And they know they have to act, but they don't know what they're acting toward.
Well, they're given general instructions of where to go, and they do have GPS. So they're given general instructions. And the idea was make them go a long distance. Don't give them a lot of food. Terrorize them when they're trying to sleep. Like that's really
yes.
the formula of how they sent them out. And apparently each character at these different checkpoints would get a motivation for the next day, but they didn't know what each other's motivations were.
Right.
So Heather's motivation might be, you need to make this movie at all costs. Josh's motivation might be, I think we need to turn around. This isn't going to work. Mike's motivation might be something different. So they don't know it. So they're given that loose direction, but that's kind of it. And Heather talks a lot about how she's like, I kind of was given a lot of free rein to make this documentary the way I wanted to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like she wasn't given a lot of instruction on how to make it. And so she was able to kind of then say, okay, as this character, what would she want, you know, based on what I think about this? And they very cleverly used the people's real names.
Yes.
And they're like, part of that was, you said verisimilitude. I can never say that word.
Verisimilitude.
and that you wouldn't be like, hey, John, I mean, Kevin, you know, you wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Or like somebody else, Kevin, and you're like, who's Kevin? Oh, shit, I'm Kevin. You know, like they wanted such a raw performance. They needed to use their own names, which Heather later said was problematic because it was challenging for her to get work after that, she thinks.
Aww.
Because like part of that being like, you know, it was actually her name. But
Right.
I remember hearing about like a creative way that they were sent on this journey. And so revisiting that for this episode was really fascinating. And I remember my cousin telling me about it. My cousin Ryan was telling me about it way back in the day, because he was watching it on, was it on VH1 or something? It's almost like pop-up video, like things were popping up, giving background.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that's a great idea. Why don't they do that for more movies? Again, director's commentary, yeah. Pop-up like information in a movie. It just wasn't a thing back then.
No.
And that's where he learned how the movie was made and all this stuff. Like, oh, they'd stash a candy bar for this person and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh my God, that's insane. So groundbreaking.
I lived for director's commentary during the DVD age. Anytime I would buy-
I do miss that.
You know, yeah. Anytime I buy a disc, I'd always look for a director's commentary, because I live for, if not that, then I live for when I'm watching a movie, I'll often pause the movie and I'll go to IMDb and look at the trivia section. Like I have to see.
Yeah.
And in addition to knowing who all the actors are, I'm like, right. Oh yeah, I got to find this, you know, to aid my enjoyment of this movie. That's just a habit that I have. So yeah, Blair Witch broke so many barriers down. And it's interesting to hear, because a lot of people did think it was boring, which I get that comment. if you're used to movies that have a lot going on in them, then sure, because again, this is a very stripped down situation here. And if you aren't getting into the vibe of it, then you're probably not going to fall in. There are people that then thought it was boring, or not just boring. They thought, well, the shaky cam bothered them. And it bothers a lot of people of this genre.
I'm going to say this. It didn't really bother me back then. I watched it recently, like within the last year. It's bad. It's bad.
Very much.
I would love to see if someone could do a version of it where they correct for a lot of the shaky cam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I don't mind a little bit of it. It's in pretty much all these movies anyway. So you kind of have to deal with it, but it's really bad. And again, it's only after time and you go back and you're like, holy crap, this is a lot of shaking.
The first iterations of this genre and then like say the 2000s, I think, because that was also going on at the same time that the Bourne Identity and other, you know, Paul Greengrass, like the director of a Bourne sequel, he also made, he makes movies in that documentary style. And so he had a lot of movies come out around the second Gulf War. It was the hot thing in the 2000s, this shaky cam documentary style. Another one that is a huge violator of it, to break away for a second from Blair Witch, is Cloverfield.
You know, I've not seen Cloverfield, but so many people have said that.
Yes, it is. Yep. It's a really good movie. I do recommend it. It is the found footage movie meets the kaiju genre, you know, smashed together. And I saw that one in the theater a couple times and found it to be difficult to sit through just because of the shaky cam. I do get used to it to a certain extent, but I would prefer it not. So,
you know, we take for granted now that there's a lot of correction that mm-hmm. the camera will do for you, even on our phones.
Yeah.
That did not exist back then.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. The steady shot. And of course they're not going to have a gimbal out in the woods.
Right.
So, sorry, which guys.
Gimbals also make their own interesting movie where like, the camera's straight and the person is fluttering everywhere. Yes. Like it's a very,
unsettling.
It's a very weird kind of thing to look at. Like it doesn't look natural. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is one thing you do have to deal with watching, I think, movies that do involve handheld cameras.
But in retrospect, I totally do get, especially again, from a modern lens, literally and figuratively, from a modern lens, it is a little challenging to go back and watch it. It's not the whole movie. Like it's just certain parts.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I even leaned back, even though I was sitting on my couch, my face wasn't like right in front of the screen, but I was like, oh, okay.
Oh, for sure. I find myself kind of looking away with those really bad moments of the shaky.
And some people actually got nauseated from it.
Yes.
So it's like, I mean, there are just some people that it's the same people who probably get motion sickness or seasick or whatever.
Or people who, like for me, I can't do VR. I get really sick with VR. I can't handle it.
Yeah. 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 So I get it.
Absolutely. And, you know, of course, this movie also, when you compare it to other ones in the genre too, I would say a lot less happens visually in this movie than in all the other ones. So
you don't see anything really.
You really see nothing. I mean, what you do get, even whenever they do reveal something, is the, like she found a pile of something and there's some teeth in it, but
you can't almost tell. Like I thought there was an eyeball in it.
Yeah. An eyeball. You're right. There was an eyeball in there.
You know what's so funny? Do you remember the scene where they hear the voices and then there's the hands on the tent?
Yes, yes.
Oh, creepiest moment.
Mm-hmm.
And they go run out and then Heather's running. She's like, what the fuck is that?
Yes.
Apparently, whoever had the camera was supposed to like pan over and see a figure that was supposed to be the witch, but they forgot to do that. So they never looked over. There was actually someone standing there.
No. Opportunity to
like
see
an all white supposed to be the witch
or what you think is
the witch, and that never happened because they didn't like point at it, which once again we don't see what's off camera. Right, on one hand, to me I think it's kind of a blessing in disguise.
Right,
I don't want to see anything. I like that I don't know that what they see. That is scarier to me.
I like that what they hear, that sensory deprivation.
Yes.
And in the moment in the very dark woods. And
I'm sorry, when you're in the middle of the creepy ass woods and there's children laughing, get me out of there.
Yeah. And Chris spends a lot of time in the woods, like probably more than I have or ever will.
I'm sorry. A snapping twig, like a snapping branch freaks me out, let alone child's cackling.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
No, thank you at all.
I said good day, sir.
I do feel though, and I am completely with you, that I don't need to see all the things that a lot of people think they need to see with a scary movie in order to be engaged. I feel like the movie, yes, there are some personality conflicts in it that are a little like annoying. And I don't think I'll ever forgive Josh for throwing the map away. Just never going to forgive him.
Well, and that makes no sense. Like narratively,
it's so stupid, but
it doesn't make any sense. Like that's a quibble that I think is definitely, I feel, and I fully understand people are like, why would he do that? Like it didn't sound authentic.
It didn't follow. Yeah. What was happening, even if he was feeling very spiteful, even if he was feeling just annoyed with Heather or whatever, it's like, you've doomed us all, you stupid bastard.
I mean, it'd almost be better if like, oh, I think I must have, like he went to put it in his pack and it fell out. They could still be mad at him for losing it and being a clumsy doofus or something.
Yes. Or I don't know, like if they'd made it seem like he was possessed at that point by the witch, like if he was under her sway or something like that, like they never did that either.
But then you lean too much that there is a witch.
Right. That's, well, you're right.
I don't know. I mean, it could just be a bunch of hillbillies.
Right.
I'm more afraid of the hillbillies. Like, give me and a witch
little,
any day.
And their little inbred children running around.
Seriously. You know? hillbillies would freak me out more than a witch would.
I agree.
I understand. Hillbillies, like, come on now.
We've gone full Deliverance with this story.
I've grown up in Ohio.
If you hear like a ghostly banjo, just like carrying through.
Exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, this is, to me though, I feel, and people will definitely disagree, but I feel that this stands the test of time. I've rewatched this movie. I've watched it with my kids. They love it.
And the ending is brilliant.
Yes. The ending, this is the thing. When I went and when I was doing my homework and I was like, oh, what are the YouTubers saying about Blair Witch Project these days? And so I just type Blair Witch Project into YouTube and they're like, the confusing ending explained. I'm like, there's no confusing.
There's
ending
no confusion.
Here.
Like
this is,
That's clickbait, I think.
Yeah. And then there are people, though, when I've watched it, because a lot of these YouTubers are people my kids' age, you know, in their early 20s, late teens, millennials and Zers and whatnot. And they all look at it from the perspective of a generation that grew up with found footage movies. And so they came to Blair Witch late. They probably grew up seeing like Paranormal Activity as their first found footage movie. And so they go back and watch something like Blair Witch and they're just like, no, you know, and, or they're like, man, I wish I could have been there to see it in the theater when it came out, you know, after having this viral campaign, because they also don't know a world where the internet is brand new. And so they're coming in already with social media, YouTube, all this stuff at their fingertips that we didn't have.
But what doesn't work about it though?
Well, I think for them, like a lot of the younger people are like, well, as far as found footage movies goes, again, there's not a whole lot going on in it. I think you have to be a little more patient with it because it's not sensational. There's not a whole lot there that like, you're not going to see like the ghost of something running behind you. You're not going to see, you know, something jumping out at you. You're not going to get, you know, a lot of these other movies that we'll talk about all have some elevated bit that Blair Witch doesn't have. Blair Witch is basically the Model T of the found footage movie.
I don't know though, the moment they get to that house.
Yeah, the house.
I mean, that's the thing. The moment they get to the house and they go into it, like, first off, rule number one of any horror movie, don't go into the creepy house,
no,
right?
So just
like,
don't.
I feel like that whole moment is like edge of your seat. Again, yeah. Maybe it's just because I'm a product of having seen it, you know, in real time. And so nostalgia has a big factor in us liking anything, right? That other people are like, why do you like that? That's so weird. But just like when you hit that part of the movie, and again that like distant sound of her screaming, because you're hearing it from his dad in the basement while she's coming from the second floor, and that like the screaming, and you just watch her and you're like, what is she gonna find? And you see him in the corner.
What
and
is
then
it about
falls.
People just facing a wall
standing
when
in
you
the
walk
corner.
Into a corner, mm-hmm. and somebody just standing in a corner facing it,
but it rewards you for paying attention because you remember the lore of the stand in the corner, you watch, like you remember that story. So it rewards you for paying attention to the movie.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think as endings go, it's pretty freaking great. I love an ambiguous ending done right.
Yes.
That movie nails it, because at the end, you're just like, WTF. I knew going in, it wasn't real. For some reason, I don't remember how, by the time I saw it, which is before a wide release, I saw it in a little indie movie theater in Florida with my aunt. And I remember because people were like, oh, it's real, it's real. And I was like, I felt all smug because I was like, no, it's not. Whatever. Bunch of rubes. But so it was before, you know, like wide theatrical releases where you could go see it in an AMC theater, right?
Yeah.
And I couldn't sleep.
Yeah.
It was so in my head. And like, again, every move, every sound, every like reflection of light across the wall. What was that?
These days, or really any day within the last decade and a half, if after you see a movie, you can go right to the internet and find other people that have seen that movie and that have already watched it, and they've compiled all this information about it, and you can talk to people about it. That didn't happen back then,
because we didn't have a cell phone to even text each other.
No,
I mean, like, there's no way I'm going to call your house on a landline to get screamed at by your parents because they're like, you're waking up the house.
Exactly. Like, you were alone in your terror. And this was true, really. We saw The Ring together in 2003. Well, 2002, actually, because I only remember this because I was very pregnant at the time.
That movie also screwed me up.
Very much so. But even then, after we saw it, I had nowhere to turn to. I was terrified. I heard a phone ring and I was going to pee my pants. I mean, it was just, you know, it was a very difficult time for a lot of horror movie fans, because there was nowhere to release that tension. You couldn't go anywhere. Like, even after I've watched a scary movie, I could go on YouTube and put on like some of my very favorite daily watch stuff that just makes me feel normal and happy and positive, like just release that moment. There's nothing like that back then. So there was nothing that we could do other than just suffer in silence, or find somebody and be like, did you see the Blair Witch Project? Oh my God, the ending. Oh my God. Oh my God. But otherwise they were like, no, I didn't see it. Or there are a few people like, no, I thought it was boring and dumb. You know? So it's like,
I sat in the front row and couldn't stand the shaky cam.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you really just, you don't have a tribe that you can really go to other than the people that you took with you to see it. Or people that maybe you ran into, or like you and me, you know, like, oh my God, did you see Blair Witch? What'd you think of Blair Witch? So it was really just one of those locked in its own time moments in movie history, where it's this brand new genre that we knew nothing about, with this marketing campaign that had half the audience thinking it was a real thing. It was our own kind of take on War of the Worlds in a lot of ways, because those people thought that that was really happening while it was going on, that this place in New York was being attacked by aliens and there was nothing they could do. And now we're watching this documentary, quote unquote, style film and thinking like, oh my God, this is actually found footage. We don't know who these fucking people are. These aren't actors we recognize. This is not, you know, so we're locked in this moment of thinking this is a real thing.
Well, and that's a time when there's not indie movies. Like, any movie that's out has someone you know in it. Anything that's indie or art is at an art house. It's going to be at an indie movie theater. It's going to be at an international movie theater, you know, where they're going to show world cinema. Yeah. It's not going to be at your big chain movie theater. There's going to be somebody you know in it.
It was just really great. And I feel like this movie will continue to stand the test of time. There's nothing that really ages it. I think the only thing that would age this movie now is their lack of cell phone. And even then, you can kind of just put that off as like, these are some like hipster indie filmmaker kids. Maybe they just don't have phones, you know, with them. But I feel like that even then, I would say most people would be like, well, even if they had phones, they probably wouldn't have a signal out in the middle of nowhere. So the phone would be useless. In a movie like Blair Witch, you know, there's always that running subgenre of films like a cell phone ruins this movie, like Home Alone. So,
I mean, that's most movies these days. I mean, that's what screenwriters really have to deal with. They're like, cell phones ruin everything from a screenwriter's perspective.
As a novel writer, I find myself going like, I can't just have a cell phone anymore. Like, somebody just get someone's cell phone, because now I have to think, how do they get into it? Mm-hmm. Do you know the passcode? Do you have a fingerprint? Oh, look, you can't just open someone's phone. So it just creates this whole new barrier.
Unless you cut their face off and put it on your face. So the facial ID recognizes
you. Just pull a Hannibal Lecter.
Exactly.
but you watch some movies.
Yeah, we should talk about more movies. We've talked about zero movies, basically. How is this even possible? Hour and a half, because it's so exciting. That's why.
I talked about Deadstream. We talked about Blair Witch. I talked a little bit.
I don't know if we talked about movies that we love.
I talked about Grave Encounters. I did like that one. I watched, and this will be handy for both of us, because I watched Wreck. And you're more familiar. I saw Quarantine, the movie that was
REC, by the way, not REC, like, not WREC.
It's a Spanish film from the early 2000s. The film Quarantine came out, I think, 2009, 2008, somewhere around there.
Sure. I'm going to go with you on that.
And that was a remake of the Spanish film, and yes. Stars, was it her, Jennifer Carpenter? Was that her name?
Dexter's sister.
Yeah. Yeah. Dexter's sister. That was Deb, starring Deb. So I had seen Wreck many, many years ago, like barely remember. Again, I just kind of went through a phase. I think it was during my Netflix envelope phase, when I saw a lot of horror movies, back when Netflix movies came in envelopes. Yes, people, that was a thing. But I put it on the other night because I'm like, I'm trying to refresh. I haven't watched a lot of horror movies in a while. So I put that one on. And I will say this, I love this concept, because you start it with a news reporter. She is bunking in with a local fire department for the night, to see what they do, like during their night shift and going out on calls and stuff like that. It's like just a human interest kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the fire department gets a call to this building. Like, we got to go and, you know, see what's going on. Right. So they hop in and they go, and she's just this intrepid journalist.
It's exciting. She's actually, there's a call. I mean, she could be there. There's no call. It's a boring night at the firehouse.
She's got her cameraman. So it's a good setup. You know where the camera is. 100%. You know what's going on.
Here's the question. Is there a cutie patootie fireman she's talking to?
Yeah, I think there is. I think there might be.
Because Quarantine has some eye candy, Jay Hernandez.
Well, there wasn't anything quite that.
Oh, darn.
Yeah, okay. That, it was, right. They were missing that.
So Wreck is a negative in its category right
yeah,
now.
No eye candy. But they get to the building and they suddenly find that they are being locked inside. The fire crew, the news crew, and the residents of this building, because there is an outbreak of some kind that the people outside know about, the cops might know about, that we know nothing about. And it turns out that these people are essentially turning into zombies.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to, again, quarantine this building to keep the outbreak contained. And so they're going floor to floor, you know, dealing with these residents who are
kind of rabid.
Yeah. It's,
is that fair to say?
It's like a 28 days later kind of situation.
Yeah. 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 Not a slow shamble walking dead monster. We're talking like feral running, clawing, scratching, now, biting crazy.
You might need to clue me in, because I've not seen Quarantine since I saw it in the theater. I do remember not loving it. I felt like it was okay. I just didn't feel like it was great. This movie shares with the American remake a very similar scene where the two female leads are like face deep in the camera, like holding on, and then all of a sudden they're pulled into the darkness by something and screaming, like away from the camera. It's a great shot. Both versions do this.
Yes.
But I feel like the Spanish version did a little more with other people in the building. There was a little girl who was infected and she's running around being a scary little kid. Like,
that's in Quarantine.
People. Okay. I couldn't remember. So there is the creepy,
there's
little
like an
kid.
Older lady. There's like, there's like five or six different residents, maybe even more, that they're kind of with. I think there's like a dad and a kid or something. Yeah, there's a little bit of that business for sure.
Here's where my problem with it came in, and this falls under the chain of custody violation, is that once we get to a certain point where it looks like the cameraman has been incapacitated and then she's carrying the camera or somebody else is carrying it, at some point you get these fuzzy little like static, and then it cuts. And then all of a sudden we have more camera footage, and it isn't clear who has the camera or who's taking this footage. And it does this multiple times. This is toward the end of the movie.
Okay.
And it really felt like they got tired of trying to explain who was taking the footage. And so there's just all this footage tacked on, and there is nothing preceding this film in any way that says that, oh, we recovered this footage and edited it together for time, sort of like they did with Grave Encounters.
Right.
There's the film producer that they recovered. All we know is that they recovered this stuff and they assembled it into one thing of raw footage.
Right.
There's nothing about that in Rec that explains why, when you get to about the last 15 minutes of this movie, it's just a bunch of stuff spliced together and you don't know how it was. And so it broke the immersion, which was like the big violation.
I don't remember that in Quarantine.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty clear who had it. And I don't remember those jumps.
Yeah.
There might be in there. It's been a little while since I've seen that movie. Probably, maybe last year, I probably revisited it.
I recommend it though. I feel like the acting is really good and I recommend doing the subtitles. I didn't have any other option. And what I watched, I always recommend subtitles in foreign films, regardless if you can do it, because
I recommend them in English films half the time. Cause
the sound mixing so bad.
The sound mixing is terrible. Yeah. It's like, you're straining to hear something. All of a sudden there's a massive explosion and you're blown back in your seat and you're like, can we turn
the voices up? Just a tad.
Just a little bit, please. Make it more consistent.
Yeah. Put a little more budget into the sound mixing. So what is a movie you watched, Chris?
I mean, I want to get to the big one that I know we both want to talk about, but I think that's the best kept secret movie.
Yes, we will definitely put that on the back burner.
Willow Creek is one I absolutely adore.
I have not seen this one, so you're going to have to tell me about it.
Yeah, so it's actually directed by Bobcat Goldthwait. If you know the 80s, you know him. If you don't, you're like, who's this dude and what now?
He was great. He's great.
Because he was around and kind of disappeared. I think he did go more behind the camera. But the premise of this one is husband and wife. The husband's really interested in Bigfoot. He wants to go to California and recreate the Patterson-Gimlin footage of Bigfoot. If you don't know what those words mean, it's that iconic shot of Bigfoot. She's walking through, you know, next to a stream, turns and looks, and you get that iconic pose.
Mm-hmm.
That's from like 76, I believe. Anyway, he wants to go and try to recreate that and see if they can find Bigfoot. And much like Blair Witch, the first part of the movie, you get to know the characters, and then they're going to the town and they're talking to a lot of the residents, because that part of California, I'm trying to remember the area, it's like northern kind of coastal California. They take Bigfoot very seriously.
Oh, okay.
Like, you can't go there in real life. You can't go there and be like, all right, so where's this old Hoaxosaurus Rex? Like, these people will not put up with your crap. Like, they're true believers.
Yeah.
And so they're kind of in this town talking to people before, again, they set off in the woods. So very similarly to Blair Witch, you get a lot of the lore and the mythology built in before you even get out there, which is super cool. And I think they do a good job of the dynamic between the couple, younger couple, I would say, late 20s. Maybe early 30s. There's a good dynamic between them. One obviously is a bit more obsessive than the other. So you get that kind of, at a certain point, dude, why are you doing this vibe? But but I think it does really well. And all I'll say is there's a scene in the movie that is like 20 some minutes uncut, just a long, terrifying, just you sit with the tension scene. It's so freaking good. It's so good.
It's sort of like maybe not quite, but like, there's the roller coaster at a park here in Ohio called Kings Island, and the roller coaster is called the Beast. And it's like a pretty standard wooden coaster at the beginning.
Sure.
And then when you get about halfway through it, that bitch kicks up to 40 miles an hour and is just like a rocket going through like all these tunnels and stuff. And you're just like, and you're freaking out. And it's also the world's longest wooden coaster, I think, to this day. So
still,
it's like you get through it to a certain point and then it just doesn't relent. And I love the sound of that. It just sounds like a great endurance test. I love movies that do that.
I highly recommend checking this one out. I think it's it's not my favorite entry into found footage, but it's definitely like a top entry. I'm not really good at ranking things numerically, but it's a top entry I would always recommend to people who like found footage.
Well, I'm going to definitely watch that this season. And I had not seen that, and I don't know that I knew about it until you mentioned it. So, and again, there's so many of these, right?
There's not a lot of good ones though. So that's the thing, like, to help curate the good ones, it's almost word of mouth, or you just, watch and hope.
And so that brings me to one that kind of lived in limbo for a long time, and then was finally like, it finally found a home with a distributor. It was made again in that sort of late 2000s era. And then I think it was officially released around 2013, 14, the Poughkeepsie tapes.
Poughkeepsie.
Thank you.
Poughkeepsie. I think Poughkeepsie is in New York.
Yeah. It's like upstate kind of environment. And this is a serial killer snuff film type found footage movie that is framed with a police documentary like around it. They're trying to catch this killer who has been terrorizing people. And there are a lot of tapes that they have found at the scenes of these crimes. And when they finally find the cache of
is it like the killer's calling card almost?
Pretty much.
The tapes?
Leaves the tape in and shows each murder happening as it happens. Mm. And this killer takes different guises. He goes from being like a Bundy type to a Dahmer type to a Zodiac killer type. He likes to taunt the police. He likes to leave little messages for them and little clues for them. And then it's also framed around the fact that there is this female victim that he has kept prisoner for many years, that they're trying to follow the scenario of what happened to her. And it takes all these interesting twists and turns, what the police go through trying to find him. There are images from this that are very disturbing. I don't think there's anything about this movie that from a storytelling perspective will make you feel good, like at all. Not that found footage is known for this, because possibly a hallmark of this genre is you don't get resolution in most cases. Mm. They end very abruptly. And you already know in many ways that your main cast is dead whenever you start.
Yeah, the end is usually the last person dies. Like that's kind of how it goes, because it's found footage. No one's really around anymore.
Yeah, no final girl happening in found footage. And so, but there kind of is one in this to a certain extent. And that's all I'll say about it. But it does take many twists and turns. But I will say that even though it has some editorial, like I would have needed I would love a tighter edit. I feel like a better edit would have made this movie go from like a B to an A.
Right.
But it is very well worth watching. It's disturbing in a lot of ways, and it goes places that you don't expect it to go. And it's very graphic and shows some imagery that I don't think you see in a lot of really anything. So I would definitely recommend this one, because it is a very inventive entry into. I just feel like the acting and the editing, you know, could be a little better. But the thing is, you're working with a lot of amateur actors in a lot of these movies, so some are going to be better than others where that's concerned.
Yes, 100%.
So what next?
Oh goodness, there's so many.
I know. We're trying to like pick and choose like some of our faves, and you know.
I mean, we got to talk about Paranormal Activity.
Yes,
I really do feel like that's like the next, you know, if Blair Witch kind of set things off, I feel like the next movie to kind of, although is this before or after quarantine?
I think it's after. And here's the thing too. I have not seen the sequels to this. I hear that they are, several are worth watching. I have not seen them. I will say though that this movie is my son Nate's favorite horror movie. He terrifies him every time he sees it. It is like the movie for him. I think this is like his Blair Witch, because like that was the first found footage movie I think he saw, and it just freaks him out to this day. And when I saw it, I remember, again, this had a great viral marketing campaign behind it. I think this was around 2006, 2007. And I remember they were showing clips of it, and then they were
2009.
And they were showing various audience reactions.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
And you would see people in the theater just screaming, and we're like, oh, we're going to that. Oh my God, we are so going. And I remember pre-ordering tickets and just the whole shebang just to be able to see this.
So they didn't have like home cameras, but they did end up setting up cameras at different points in the house.
Okay.
So they do that in the first one. And then in the future ones, it's like, you know, it's almost like home security camera footage, but the effect is the same, which is, this is, I think, one of the first movies where, oh, we're going to set up the cameras, and then they go to bed at night.
Yes. Oh my God.
And then it goes through, it switches cameras throughout the house, and it kind of just very methodically does that. And then sometimes you see the time signature fast forward and then it stops.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that is such a great cue that you're not even realizing the tension that that ramps up. But it's like when it stops, you're like, oh shit, something's going to happen. And I just thought Paranormal Activity did a great job of that. And it has a very kind of subtle backstory that I think it worked well. Like, this isn't one where there's a lot of,
lore.
It's not like Blair Witch where, yeah, there's a mythology and a lore that we have to explain. It's just a little bit of backstory of like the main character, Katie, and then Micah, her boyfriend, and like a little bit kind of unfolds, but for the most part, you don't know what's going on.
It is essentially a possession story. So you get a little bit about how she might have been exposed to different demonic elements that might have infiltrated her. And I am just a sucker for possession stories. I fucking love them.
Which surprises me. You've only seen the first one of this movie.
I know. I think I have a sequelitis problem in everything, you know, and it's not because I think that the sequel is going to be bad. I just feel like, okay, I had my thing and then the sequels happen and I just miss them. The one part of Paranormal Activity, and there are a few parts in it that are terrifying, but the one that gets me every single time is toward the end when, you know, she's lying on the couch and the boyfriend's talking to her and he goes away and she looks right in the camera. I just got fucking chills again. Yes, just thinking about it, because I'm like, yes, it's got her. Oh my god. Yeah, it's got her. And then so at that point the freaking brakes are off the coaster.
But to me, it's like it's the fast forward of her just standing still. Oh. And she's just in fast forward, like bobbling back and forth.
For
but
like
not
hours.
Moving.
She stood there for hours.
Cause you see her, I think she gets up out of the bed and like stands over him, but just stands there. It's so weird. Like nothing happens, but it's just so freaking creepy.
So scary. Oh. There are so many great subtle moments in that framing of the shot with the bed and the hallway. You know, because a lot of people have that exact same house setup. My house could almost be filmed similarly. And it really captures that moment, of course, when things happen down the hall and he gets up and he's got to run down there's so many moments in that movie that utilize that setup really well.
But it's also a modern house. It's not a creepy old mansion. It's just not a colonial old thing where you've got this like Revolutionary War ghost in it. Yeah. It's a modern freaking cookie cutter house. And you just don't see that a lot in horror movies. It's always the old place. It's always the creepy remote place.
Right.
This is just suburbia.
Because the devil followed her wherever she went, you know? And then I know that lore, I think, gets more developed in the sequels, like how that happened.
So I've seen 5 of the movies.
Okay.
I believe there are 7.
Okay.
What I will say, quality wise, surprisingly consistent. The 5th one was fine, in my opinion. The first 3, I think, are really good.
Okay.
And I think 4 is decent. And 5 was like, okay. I do at some point plan to watch the more recent ones. And I think the last one was even from like, was it 2021? So very recent. But I'm kind of invested now. I want to know what happens. It does sort of build on the lore, but not in ways that you might expect. And so I just think each movie tends to do it in an inventive way. Not that anything is new about how they do it, the use of the different cameras throughout the house. And I think they all do a pretty good job of explaining why they're there.
Yeah.
You know, because again, if there's a camera, why is it there? Why is it recording? Well, it's sort of easy when it's like, we just have cameras in our home for security purposes or whatever. That's not an uncommon thing, particularly, you know, if you have kids or whatever. I think the first 3 are, if nothing else, if you like this movie, watch the first 3. If you still enjoy them, keep going.
Okay. Okay.
And I'd say that to anybody, but yeah.
For sure. And, you know, and I think in a lot of ways it kind of reinvigorated the genre a little bit. I think it had kind of flagged a little because really when I was doing my research on the found footage movies that I liked and enjoyed and watched more recently, they really came out around 2012, 2013. There were, you know, quite a few around that period.
Well, and I just want to say real quickly, I don't know of very many horror movies that can survive this many sequels and still be pretty good quality.
Yeah, you're right. Cause I think even like the Saw movies, it kind
like
of fell
Saw,
off.
Yeah, there's Saw.
Nightmare on Elm Street. I mean.
Yeah, but you know, those are like
they're very different and they reinvent themselves. It's a different
tone, right? And like some of the tones are like really bizarro, but to have a movie series or franchise stick to an internal story and a tone,
right?
That's pretty rare. And to have this many that are at least decent.
Yeah.
Because so many of these go off the rails real fast. I mean, look how quickly Blair Witch went off the rails.
Very
it's
much.
Like a movie, right?
Very much.
Yeah. And that's not uncommon. And like, I've seen Quarantine 2.
Oh, they had a second one? Oh, okay.
They did. It was fine, but I didn't think it was necessary. But these, it's rare.
That's very rare.
All right, what else you got?
Another one I watched, As Above, So Below.
On my recommendation?
Yes, yes.
Now, I saw this maybe a year, year and a half ago, something like that. You just watched this.
I just watched it, and it is so different in a lot of ways. I love, of course, it has a great setup in terms of what it is. So there's this woman, her father was a famed archaeologist, and, you know, she's continuing his work because he died. She's continuing his work, and it starts out great. And if in fact, I would say this movie does kind of start off at a higher pace in its own way, because she's
in Dali too much. Yeah.
Yeah. She's investigating in a tunnel in Iran, I think it was, and trying to get to something. And then the tunnel's being demolished as she's down there because the government is trying to block off this whole area from people exploring it. And so it starts off at quite a pace, and then you come off and then you see that they're setting up this whole documentary of her, because she is searching for the Philosopher's Stone, which is not just a Harry Potter thing, guys.
Which, by the way, JK did not come up with that.
No, she did not. No.
Nor the name Nicholas Flamel. Like
no, that's no, right. Because he was the original alchemist, right? So if you have any passing interest in alchemy or witchcraft or this kind of archaeology, history, whatnot, this has a great appeal.
Or the Catacombs of Paris.
Oh my God. Yes.
Because, I mean, that was the draw for me. I'm like, I'm sorry. I found footage movie about the creepy ass catacombs of Paris. You've got me.
That is on my bucket list. I want to go to there very badly. So they're still looking for this Philosopher's Stone. She assembles this crew, essentially the documentarian and somebody else. And they go down there because all their clues point toward there. They got to get a certain distance below Paris. And of course, the catacombs is how one does that. And from that point on, this takes on a whole kind of interesting, magical Dante's Inferno. I compare it to the nine levels of hell, is the metaphor that this takes. And it's astoundingly good. I really do think on this whole list of what we're talking about, I think this is probably the most artistically interesting.
Yes, that's a great way to put it. Yep. But still accessible. Like it doesn't get too like art housey, like into itself.
No. I honestly didn't feel cut off from it at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, this is one of a few of these. Like, I definitely want to see this again. Like, this is one that I feel like I probably missed a few things the first time, and like I want to go back and rewatch it.
I have one thing against it.
Mm-hmm.
It stars Jonah from Superstore. Like that, but you know,
yeah.
One of the appeals of found footage is these are unknown people you don't recognize. And so it puts you into the reality mindset, even though your brain knows it's not reality. I don't know these people from Adam.
It busts the immersion.
Yeah. But when you have a main character from a popular many-year sitcom, and I mean, it's not The Office, it's not Parks and Rec, but a lot of people watch Superstore.
Right.
And so for me to immediately be like, well, that's Jonah. First off, I don't even know what the character's name is. He's just Jonah from Superstore. And not that he did a bad job in the movie, but I didn't want to recognize anybody.
You know, what's I found really interesting is when I was looking this up, it only has like a 27% on Rotten Tomatoes, which
that's insane.
I'm like, what is going on? Did we watch the same movie? Because this is not a 27%. This is definitely like, I would definitely easily give this one a B+. So I definitely would put it on the list of you should definitely see.
This is definitely one where like, don't believe the mass response to it. Like this is not where the wisdom of the crowd really comes into place here.
Right.
Plus I think it has one of the best names of any movie ever. As Above, So Below is just so great.
Good. Which again, I think counters to, I think that's also part of the Dante's Inferno.
I believe so.
Or part of some of the similar. Yeah, very much. And I think there's also like other references to it. Like, abandon all hope, ye who enter here, you know, just things like that. So it is really a great part of that whole mythology, and just something about descending deeper into the earth or below a city or anything like that is just naturally terrifying. I don't even like going into my parents' basement, so you know, going into or the underground tour in Seattle, I mean, come on, you know, you're just looking at these rusty iron beams holding an entire city up and you're just like earthquake.
I would love to see more about like urban exploration.
Agreed.
You know, like old, like one of my favorite things from the Ghostbusters sequel was when they're in that creepy old tunnel that had been abandoned.
Yes.
And then they find the river of slime. Like that part is so cool to me because it's like this long forgotten thing that somehow brought back to life or whatever.
I love that. Or getting really something that does go into those old abandoned subways. I think that would be brilliant. Yes. And that's another thing I loved about Grave Encounters and the twist that that one takes. I compared it to a Blair Witch meets Session 9 because they're in this abandoned mental hospital. And I love what it does with, I'll just say, the element of time, because it isn't enough that they're locked into this building and they have to, you know, record ghosts and find ghosts. It's this ghost hunting crew, totally a ripoff of Ghost Adventures. They even like,
oh yeah,
really, really take away from some of those popular ghost hunting shows. But they're in there, they're locked away, and they are under the directive that they're going to be unlocked at 7 a.m. But then, you know, they get so caught up in what's going on and the stuff that's happening because all this supernatural stuff starts kicking off and they're going through all this stuff. And then they're like, oh, we're going to get out of here. Well, the daylight never comes. The sun's supposed to come up. It never does. They check the time. It's still dark. They go through where they think the exit is after they break the door down and find more hallways. They're essentially trapped in this labyrinth. And that is terrifying. Mm-hmm. And then add into the fact there's all these elements going on around them and that people are slowly going insane. It becomes increasingly claustrophobic as it goes. It's a really inventive way to deal with, like, we're trapped in this one place. Well, let's make it more than just a building. Let's make it like this time warp or this dimensional rift that you're caught in. And it's just, it's really good. I think that there are definitely some weaknesses to it, but it's really well made. And I think it is a very worthy entry. So
I think it's a decent entry. Yeah. I would put it somewhere in the, if you love the genre and you're running out of options and haven't seen it, definitely watch it.
Yeah. Totally worth the watch. So
I feel like this, we're going on forever. We don't have to talk too much about it, but this one I don't see on a lot of lists and I am shocked. The Last Exorcism.
Oh my God. That is a very, very good one.
Oh my God. I don't see it on a lot of lists, like the listicles of like the 13 best, the 20 best or whatever. This one does not show up a lot. And I am dumbfounded.
Again, if it has an exorcism or a demonic element, I'm in.
Yeah.
And this has some really great imagery.
But you have this charismatic evangelical, he's a preacher, right?
Right.
He's an evangelical preacher, super charismatic, but he knows it's BS.
Yes.
And he does all of these like exorcisms, but it's all fakery. He shows you how it's fakery, but it's kind of documented this whole process. And then he gets this phone call that he wants to go investigate. But I think it's Last Exorcism because I think he's like, this is the last time I'm doing this and I'm done, right? Like,
right.
It's nonsense. I'm tired of it or whatever. So you just have this really like charismatic guy, but it's like in rural deep South, terrifying enough. Hard pause right there. That's to me, always been like a creepy part of the country. Rural deep South. I don't know why, but you have that aspect in it. And then you're right. You have this like, just this, again, a slow burn of things that unravel. But the ones that stick with me, to your point, have an image I can't get out of my head. And we've mentioned The Ring, and I know it's not found footage, but the image of the girl in the closet.
Yes.
Stuck in my head forever. And in this one, it's the image of the girl in that like impossibly contorted position.
Yeah.
And that to me is like one of the hallmarks of these movies too, is like sometimes you just catch a glimpse of a thing or whatever, but it's just this like haunting image that just doesn't look right. And it sticks in your head and you can't get rid of it. And Last Exorcism does that really well. And it's just a delightful movie. And I don't know why it's not on more lists. It's kind of
I agree. And that reminds me, the Poughkeepsie Tapes, it has similar, like, it's one of those where it's like, the killer presents in a way that makes you not only wonder who, but what he might be. And because of body positioning, like anytime you see like a contorted person and you got the lighting just right and the scenery just right. Oh yeah. Every time you mentioned the girl in the closet in the ring, and already I know I'm like, I'm sitting here in a really dark garage right now. And I'm just like,
I'm in a dark apartment.
I know.
Yeah. It's just like, it's creepy.
I was talking about this movie earlier and I was just like, man, this movie makes me not want to walk through my darkened hallway right now. Cause it is just one of those. And so the possession movies that kind of play with the frame rate, or they'll, you know, do something to make it look just not quite right. Which again, I know you didn't like Lake Mungo, but there is a use, the use of pareidolia in that movie is really good. The way that the brain reads faces into things that may not be there.
That is true.
That is a really powerful fright device. And so it does that. I will say the thing about Lake Mungo, it gets a little convoluted in its plotting.
And it doesn't really go anywhere.
It's a documentary style. And in the family that is portrayed in this movie, because they've lost a daughter, right? They are, and this is an Australian film. Their daughter was found drowned in a lake. And so they're trying
were at the lake when
they were at the lake. Right. And they are trying to piece together their lives again in the wake of her death. And so it first becomes like them making the documentary about that. And then it kind of becomes a ghost story because she's popping up in some of these images and in this footage and all this. And then it takes a lot of twists and turns as it goes, because it's like, oh, the ghost stuff was made up. And then, oh, there's the neighbor thing. And then, you know, and then I was like, you know, you find the mystery of how she died. And then it's like, oh, who was Alice? This is the murdered girl.
Well, and then they actually go to Lake Mungo.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
It doesn't take place there. Like, that's not the lake she drowns in. Like, you don't get introduced to Lake Mungo until like 2/3 into the movie.
I think the pacing of the movie was,
I think it's the pacing. Yeah. And I think it felt like, even though it went too long, it felt like half a movie. Like, it didn't feel like it really ended. And again, I don't mind an ambiguous ending, but I was just like, it was an unsatisfying ambiguous ending. I will say the end credits, we won't say what it is, but the end credits play a lot with you rethinking about the whole movie. And I've not seen a movie that does that successfully in the credits.
Right. I think it is absolutely worth a watch. I think it will.
Sure.
I liked the actors in it. I think they did a really good job because apparently they were given no direction. These were improv actors.
Oh, really? They did a great job. I think there's nothing wrong with the acting. I mean, the presentation was fine. Maybe it was a pacing thing, and then just it felt like it didn't feel fully formed.
It needed to take, I think, a few links out of the chain and bridge it together and make it a little more simplistic. It was trying to do too much. Once you remove a few things and just tighten it up a little bit, it's like perfect.
I think one more editing pass could have potentially done it, or just tighten up the screws a little bit. Yeah, maybe that's what it is.
But
I if it's like you're looking for something new, and I haven't seen a lot of found footage from other countries. You know, this is an Australian take on it. And I also would love to talk about Troll Hunter.
This is on a lot of top lists.
Yes. And so this one takes place in Norway and is in language. So you'll need subtitles unless you speak the language. And it's kind of this idea that this, again, group of teens, they're going to go out and document some strange occurrences. I think bears are being mutilated and they're like, what's killing bears? Like, how can you kill a bear? Like, what predator out there is like doing this? And so they start this whole expedition, and then there's like this guy that they're kind of like, what's his deal? He seems really mysterious, and like he sort of gets pulled into the story. And all I'll say is trolls. So like it is really the direction it goes. And I want to say zero more than that, but it's a very well done movie that starts with a premise, takes you on a journey, and it goes in directions you don't expect and is very pleasant. And Norway's not bright and sunny, 300 days a year of sunshine kind of a place. So you've got the atmosphere already. It's a beautiful country, but much like Seattle, it's shrouded often in gloom and overcast. And so you get that aspect of it, but it just keeps building all these different layers into it and is it's a cool movie. It's done very well. This is a movie I would say must watch.
Okay.
This is not a, if you can, this is a must watch. Watch Troll Hunter. There's one more I would love to talk about before we get to our big one that I know we both really, 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 sure. really like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Have you seen Creep?
Only the first one. I have not seen, I know there's a couple of them.
There's two. The second one's also very good, but help me understand how this one is different from other movies and found footage. Like, it's so, is it just because the guy is genuinely creepy, the main actor?
Oh, for sure.
The guy puts an ad, I think like a I need someone to record me for a project. And then this guy comes out to this house out in the middle of nowhere.
Out in the middle of nowhere, remote cabin situation.
Yeah. And he meets this guy who wants to make this movie about himself.
Because he's dying. He has a tumor. He's like,
oh, is that what it is? Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. I forgot what the premise
was. And he's trying to get a video made before his wife gives birth, because he's supposed to die like before his kid's born. I think he's like wanting to make that whole like, this is me, I'm your dad.
And he's just acting weird in different ways and doing some bizarre shit. And but he also wants to kind of be like friends with this guy who's the filmmaker that comes.
Just feels like almost like an Annie Wilkes or a Fatal Attraction or, you know, something like that, where the person you're dealing with, you know, is not quite right.
And also we're introduced to a suit, an outfit.
Yeah.
A mask. That is genuinely terrified.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
This is a good one. This is
And I will say the second one I went into skeptical, because I'm like, how do you kind of redo this?
Well, yeah, how do you achieve beyond, right?
I would say very successfully. So I would say watch, if you watch Creep and you like it, watch Creep 2.
Okay, this one just, this is one of the ones that just puts a knot in my stomach, you know.
It's a little more unsettling in a way that I can't really articulate.
It gets the dread factor, I think, in a way that some of these don't. It makes me feel more uncomfortable. And maybe just because it involves direct personalities a bit more.
Maybe because it's not supernatural. It's not an unknown thing. Yes. The monster is like in front of you the whole time.
As opposed to the external thing. You, like you said, the ghost or the monster or whatever like that. So I think you're right. I think that could be why it is a lot more unsettling. Because I think most of these movies do revolve around a supernatural element of some kind, because it's the best way to portray a supernatural element without coming off cheesy or having to involve too many special effects. So when you're just dealing with a stalker type.
No, that's a great point. That's a great point. Okay. I couldn't put that into words. I think that's helpful, because this one's just like unsettling in that very different way. I think we've held off long enough.
Okay.
We need to talk about The Best Kept Secret.
Yes.
Hell House LLC.
You were on me for years.
For too long.
To watch.
You
this
waited
movie.
Too long to watch this freaking movie. It was at least over a year. Was it years?
Oh, it was. It was. Okay. You mentioned, I think it was for a couple at least. And I can't even remember what finally inspired me.
Bugged you again and was like, girl, you need to watch it's probably Halloween like last year or something.
It
I was like, watch the freaking movie.
It was about it. Yeah, it was about a year ago.
Because you were probably like, we're trying to figure out a movie to watch. And I'd be like, I done told you for years what you should be watching.
I know. And I'm like, and I think I told you after I finally watched Hell House LLC. I did the thing.
Here's the best part. It's a haunted house movie in a haunted house.
Yes. But
what that means is it takes place at a manufactured haunted house. Jumps and scares, booze. I'm going to go wait in a line and go through this haunted house with all the manufactured scares. It takes place in that setting. It's so brilliant. Something creepy is actually happening in a place that's meant to be creepy.
One of the most inventive reasons to have cameras on site, in spades. Yep. It also utilized the whole documentary setup. It also utilized the type of found footage that you find on phones. It used phones very well.
Yep.
And it just, and the documentary part has a continuing story as well that gets folded into it. So the story is continuing to happen as the documentary is being made. So that's the other thing that unsettles you is like when you're normally watching these documentary style ones, you just assume that there's already been enough removal from the event that we're just documenting the moment. No, it isn't over when they're making this. So it turns on itself, and it, like all the tropes, all the things that found footage movies have done, it just elevates it to a whole other place and takes advantage of, again, the different types of horror. Because, you know, talking about the jump scares, yes, there are some of those in this, but this takes advantage of your mind's ability to observe multiple things going on at the same time.
And it's also a Where's Waldo, because you're trying to pay attention to something going on when there's freaky shit everywhere, because it's a haunted house.
Yes.
You've got dummies, you've got, you know, a creepy figure sitting at a piano.
Yes.
You've got clowns, for God's sakes. You've got all these different things. So it's like, normally in these movies, like a Paranormal Activity, you're trying to find the signal in the noise, right? It's this boring kitchen, a boring living room. And you're right. Like, okay, what's going on right now? I've got to scan this room. I got to pay attention, like you said. Well, this is, everything's creepy because it's a freaking haunted house. So you're like, okay, is that creepy clowns really scary or is it not?
Yeah.
And it starts off brilliantly because it starts off with a disaster. You just know that something bad happens at this haunted house attraction. I think on the night it opens, right?
Yes, the first night.
And so you're seeing this news report of something going south. And I think you see a little bit of the cell phone footage because, you know, people waiting in line, they're all scared or whatever. And then you kind of jump back to this group of friends who are, like you said, they're documenting going in together on this haunted house. They want to, I think it's like an old inn.
Yeah, it's called the Abaddon Hotel. And that's like a whole other thing in general, like the term Abaddon, it's like already.
Is that Greek or is it, what is that Abaddon from? Isn't it like a gate to hell? Or
yes,
something?
It is. It is related to like hell. There is a whole lore, you know, demonic lore associated with that name. So when you see that, and it's, they didn't name it this. The people who acquired this property to develop it into a haunted attraction, that was the name of the inn already. Well,
and that's a great Easter egg. Like you don't necessarily need that to know anything about the movie. Like you can follow not knowing that, but it's definitely one of the things that if you do know it, you're like, oh, I mean, it's called Hell House, right? So you already, the hell connection is not a big leap, but nevertheless, it's just one of those fun little like tidbits thrown in there that a person who knows, or if upon going back and looking into the movie, you're like, whoa, no kidding. Like that's the kind of fun stuff that can be kind of tucked away in a movie.
Abaddon appears in the Book of Revelation, is both a place of destruction and an angel of the abyss. So there's a little bit going on with that. In the Hebrew Bible, okay. Abaddon is used with a reference to a bottomless pit, often appearing alongside the place Sheol or Sheol, meaning the resting place of dead people. And then an nightmare. Angel called Abaddon is described as the king of an army of locusts. His first name is transcribed in Greek. So it is Greek. And yeah, is translated as to mean destroyer. So this is a very, when you know your lore about, you know, Revelations and, you know, the supernatural Bible type stuff and any kind of stuff from that period. Yeah. This is a name that, you know, if you know that stuff, you're like, I'm not going there. I'm not going to a town called Abaddon. I'm not going in a place called Abaddon.
You're like, nope, nope, nope. Middle fingers up. And you're just going back into the ocean. Absolutely. Yeah. So it just kind of goes from there. As they're putting this haunted house together, this attraction, tensions rise, weird things are happening.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes off the rails from there. And it's best not to know much more than that. Only that this is one of the best kept secrets in the found footage genre. I would put this at the top.
Yeah, I really would as well.
I really would.
I remember when I was watching this thing, I was like the classic person in the theater yelling at the TV, like, don't do that. Oh yeah. My God. Like, cause going back to the laws we mentioned earlier, it takes advantage of the placement of the cameras. And so showing us things that the characters can't see, we can see so much that they don't know. There is so much going on in this house, and the supernatural stuff and the scares do not wait very long. They are kind of like happening. And what adds that extra layer of suspense and horror is that the people involved just assume it's part of their work. They're making scary props. They're setting up all this stuff. And so you know, they might go like, why is that doll like there? Or why is it moved? Did you move the doll? Or they just assume someone else did it. And so it just, nobody knows what's really happening. And the thing is, the movie does start off with that opening night, and you get the archival footage of people running out, and you know, it's all going very badly.
I got chills again. I'm thinking of a stairwell scene.
Oh my god. Yeah. And there is like even a scene too where like one of the guys, he's doing, because one guy, he does kind of like a confessional video in his bedroom, you know, as he's wrapping up the night, getting ready to go to sleep. And there's even shit in the background.
Oh my God. You're so right.
And so it's like, even in a safe moment, in a safe place, because every one of these movies in a way has like moments and places where you feel safe. Like there is like a respite area. So all this crazy shit's going on out here, but I'm in here. There's nothing like that in this place, because these people are staying in this house while they're building it out and getting it ready. And also, I love the natural conflict that happens with the fact that these are business people. They are depending on this. They need to make this work. This is their livelihood. So they can't just pack up and leave, you know, or they're like, we're going to stick it out. And they're also maybe a little jaded because this is their business, is scaring people.
Yeah. I think they had set up like successful haunted houses in other towns. So it's like they had a formula that worked and they were going to do it here. But to your point, it's like, they've invested a lot of money. They need to make a profit. So that's their motivation to continue on.
Yeah. And of course, all these people that have been working together for a while, they have their own little interpersonal conflicts. Another thing I like about this movie is it has really interesting story building and storytelling. It isn't just about this group of people we don't care about facing off this weird supernatural thing. These people have a story. They have a purpose. They have a background that makes them feel very relatable and interesting, to the point where I said earlier, even the quote unquote creep of the story is sympathetic. Like, I was like, yeah, you're just kind of like a little shithead, but you know, you're not a bad guy. So it's like, everybody knows somebody like this guy. And you just kind of like roll your eyes and laugh it off. He's a little sexist. He's a little weird, but it eventually becomes a weird sympathetic type character. And I love how it turns that whole thing on its head. This movie is probably, my favorite of the genre. I'm looking forward to a movie that can topple this one off the pedestal.
Completely agree. I would love for this to be number two because an even better movie comes out.
Yes.
Because it doesn't diminish this movie. It just means somebody's kind of taken it to the next
level. Now, have you seen the sequels to this? Because I have
not. I saw the first sequel. Me personally, stick with the first one. I guess if you just love this so much and you want to know more about the ongoing story, I think there's two more. I had no interest in seeing the third one after the second one.
After covering all this ground about found footage movies, I'm curious. I'm going to pull a page from your show, 80s High. Does this hold up? Does it stand the test of time? What is your feeling on the future of this subgenre?
Oh, I think it has a long future, provided that people are telling good stories and have good characters. It can be seen as gimmicky because some people have treated it in a gimmicky way. But the appeal of it is that psychological kind of putting you in the shoes, it's very accessible as an audience member. It's very immediate. We don't have that artifice like we do with other movies. And it's not big budget for the production company. So it can be very appealing for both the viewer and, you know, it's like reality television. It's cheap for a studio to make.
Right.
Well, this is cheap too. And so long as it's done well and technology continues to change, you know, you mentioned there's one that's done more like a Twitch chat room almost.
Yes.
Or I saw one where it was, I don't remember the name of it. It was okay. But like, it was friends talking to each other on like a Discord or, you know, a Zoom type thing. There's always like a new direction you can take it. And I think as long as you have a fresh and fun perspective and you don't cheap out on good characters or a good story, I think there's something there. So I think it definitely can stand the test of time. Now, it may not be like as much of like all the movies kind of coming out, and genres tend to come and go. Like, you don't see slashers much anymore like you did in the 80s, right?
Right.
But I think if it's done really well, absolutely it can stand the test of time.
I agree with you completely. I feel like with increasingly different ways that we communicate and share information, I think can lend itself very well to this device. And somebody will absolutely come along to do something that utilizes communication in a world that we currently understand it. We're talking on Zoom right now, and any kind of like phone, social media, Snapchat, all these kinds of things. And the way that everybody has a camera in their pocket, thanks to their phone, that is a potential found footage waiting to happen. People listening right now are probably yelling at us, like, why didn't you mention this one?
And I have like 10 more I want to talk about, but we've also gone for like 2.5 hours and could probably keep talking.
Can you just do lightning round of titles? Just, oh, sure. You know, yeah.
Butterfly Kisses.
Yes. Oh my God. I meant to watch that one and I didn't get a chance.
So close to making the list. Watch it. It's another good one of building up like an urban legend lore. It's on the end of like good solid, but not. Apollo 18 has a great premise that goes kind of in a, I didn't like where it went, but I love the idea that it's based on the moon and something's going weird on the moon. I mean, come on already.
Agreed.
There's one called Area 51.
Ah, yeah.
Again, the premise is we're going to actually find a way to get around all the security to get into Area 51.
Oh, it's like a take on, like, I think there was a few years ago, like, oh, we could have stormed Naruto Area 51. Run.
Yeah, Naruto, we're all going to Naruto run onto the base, right? So no Naruto runs, but they kind of talk about, well, here are all the security measures and here's how we can foil them. Mm. And so it's this really interesting movie. I think it's another one that's like decent. I can't say it's like the best, but I'm like, if you're interested in like alien lore and you're just fascinated by Area 51, duh, go watch it. And there's another one that's just interesting because it's made by like a guy. And he's now made, I think, like seven of these. It's called Bad Ben.
Oh, I have not heard of this at all.
And it's just, it's on Amazon. And it's just, I think it was made by a dude. And maybe like one other person's in it. And it's all about him moving into this house. Again, kind of a modern house. It's not anything ancient, old, creepy, colonial, nothing like that. And just, there's like a story that kind of unfolds. It's profoundly low budget. It just feels like there was a dude who was like, I'm bored and I want to make a movie in my house. And he did. And it's not terrible.
That's great. Okay.
Bad Ben. And he's made many of them.
And it's not your co-host on 80s High.
What? No, not my Ben. Different Ben. Okay. But
fair.
Yeah. So those are just a few of the other ones. I know there's even more, but of the ones I kind of wrote down.
Yeah,
that's what I got for you. And I should say funny mockumentaries that are not scary at all, but are really good. What We Do in the Shadows is great.
Oh, if you haven't my seen God.
That. So I much fun.
Love
so
that
much
movie.
Fun. It's not really found footage, but, you know, it's kind of in that mockumentary style.
Yeah.
And then if you like spoofs, Marlon Wayans did A Haunted House, which is like kind of making fun of primarily Paranormal Activity. But of course, much like Scary Movie, other movies in the subgenre as well, which is pretty funny. So if you like a silly movie, I know sometimes spoofs are hit or miss. I think he's done two, but the first Haunted House I've seen is pretty funny.
I feel like we have only just scratched the surface here. I mean, there are so many, and I want to hear from people.
Yes, like, we do.
What we didn't mention, please let us know, because I'm always looking to build out my list. I have discovered so many great movies just talking to Chris. And I already mentioned Brett from The Prosecutors. He gave me a huge list the other night. My mind is bursting. I've been watching so many of these things and rewatching ones that I've loved for a long time. And it's actually fun to rewatch them because I do find they still work. All the ones that I have rewatched, they still get me. So it doesn't wear off.
It's maybe not the same effect because you kind of know what's going on.
Yeah.
But what drew you into it initially is still going to draw you in and still be kind of creepy. Like, knowing what happens doesn't necessarily make it less intense for me, at least. It's kind of cool.
Sometimes you find new things that creep you out, or, you know, sometimes you notice something else in a frame. I'm not one of those people that the first time I watch something, I catch everything. Give me just the facts. Give me the bare bones. Let me get through the plot so I can understand what's going on. And then I'll go in, if I like it, I'll go back in for a rewatch and kind of come away with a whole different point of view. So definitely get these. I watched a lot of these on Shudder. A lot of them are on Tubi and Pluto TV for free. Amazon has a number of them available.
Especially this time of year, like they'll usually kind of, I think a lot of the streaming services will kind of pack a bunch of scary movies on. So you can usually find stuff that's maybe not there year round.
God, there's so many great horror movies that you can watch on just, you know, those services alone. I think Hulu was the one I watched, As Above, So Below. There are a few there, but man, Tubi is like a revelation for a horror fan. If you do not want to pay for a subscription service, like Shudder, then that is a fantastic app. And you do have to watch ads, and that can be a little disruptive for horror.
But what I will say that I loved about Tubi, because I watched one of the movies there last night at your recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
And what I loved about it is it gives you a countdown before the ad.
Yes.
So you would, oh, like Mungo, I watched on there. So you at least know it's coming. The ones where they kind of just bomb you with a commercial that's usually 18 times louder than the movie. And again, this is a movie where you're leaning in, you're trying to figure out what's going on. And all of a sudden it's like Taco Bell. And you're like, come on.
Yes.
Well, I loved it. It gave me the countdown, because also I could find my mute button and just kill the sound. But it allowed me to transition and not be pulled out of the movie quite as much.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Pluto does that, but I appreciated that a ton about Tubi.
I've not watched anything on Pluto yet. I have that. I have the app now. And I know a lot of movies that people have been recommending this season are on there. So,
for instance, I think on Amazon, my dad was here and we watched Willow Creek.
Oh, okay.
And it was on Amazon, but with ads, but you didn't know when the ads came on. So it was really jarring. And again, you're like in the middle of a scene and all of a sudden,
you know, we're in this realm of so much streaming services that, you know, we're willing to now watch ads in order to not pay as much. Why have they not found a way to put a proper cut? And like regular network TV knows where to break the show to start the commercial, and streaming services just rudely drop it in wherever. And that happens on podcasts. And by the way, if you're listening to this show, you might hear an ad and it's going to be in a weird spot. And you're going to be like, why do they do that? I have no control over that. That's just what the platform decides to do. Their little computer brain searches for a good break, and that's where they decide to put the ad. So come on, streaming services and other platforms, get it together.
I
could put up with the ad, but give me a place where I know it's coming and then I can properly ignore it. And like you can mute the TV or whatever. So, but anyway, I think this will wrap it up for now. We got lots of movies to watch and rewatch. Yes. Hopefully we've set you for the Halloween season and watch a few of these and let us know what you think. And if you have any questions, suggestions, anything like that, reach out to me at ddarknesstime@gmail.com or on Twitter at ddarknesstime, or hit me up with a review over on iTunes. Would love to hear from you, especially if you have nice things to say. And Chris, what you got going on, man?
I'm over at 80s High Podcast, where we do a little nostalgia stream of all the things you forgot you loved so much about radical decade of the 80s.
Damn right. It's a great show. Season 3 is in full swing, and I'm getting ready to start my own season 3 here very soon. We just recorded our Cults Primer episode. Chris is on there with my buddy Bart, and we are kicking butt. So that will be rolling at you real quick. And but other than that, go watch the movies, guys, and enjoy Halloween season.
Keep it spooky. Keep it creepy.
Ding Dong Darkness Time has been brought to you and produced by yours truly, Allison Dixon. It was made possible by an array of amazing co-hosts, friends, family, but especially you, the listeners. Big shouts also go out to the brilliant Nathaniel Dixon for the show art, and future legend Spencer Morlock for all the music. I'll be back again soon with another episode. In the meantime, be good, you little ding-dongs.